Hey, what's up, everybody? We're back with another edition of the Ad Podcast. And today I have a really exciting guest for you guys. Jason Dyer is a chief marketing officer at the Chief Outsiders Group, which is a network of fractional CMOs. And he has a really cool, interesting background, and we'll get into it a little bit today. But what I love about Jason's background and doing the research on him today is he's got most recently experience launching a B2B brand, experience being a high-level marketing exec at American Heart Association. So he's got philanthropy experience or nonprofit experience. Then prior to that, he launched a CPG food brand in and around the celiacs category or gluten intolerance category. So that is a pretty awesome, well-rounded marketing background, somebody that spans three of the four possible sectors. The only thing he hasn't done is work for the government. So I'm pretty excited to talk to Jason today.
Yeah, nice to be with you. Thank you, Dylan.
Yeah, you got it. So Jason, obviously I just teed up your intro a little bit. I'll also throw out there full transparency. We work with Chief Outsiders on Amelia Beauty and Ancestral Supplements, and we're in the Orange Book. And we love these guys. They're great partners, and it's always exciting to talk to another outsider. So Jason, as we hop into your background, you know, obviously I hit on the top three most recent things that you've done, but anything else you want to tell us about your background before we hop into the questions today?
Well, the beer thing is not over. I'm actually currently working with a brand new brewery to bring gluten-free beer. Yeah. And so it's one of those things I just can't put down. So it's a passion project. So I've got the chance to continue that. And so I'm really looking forward this month. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be brewing again.
Wow. That's awesome, man. Well, look, you know, I am coming up on 10 years sober. So I'm a huge consumer of non-alcoholic beer and just, you know, just have been amazed at the explosion of the category. I never got to try a non-alcohol or a gluten-free beer when I was still drinking beer. But, you know, the non-alcoholic side of things is completely just chock full of amazing options with really low carbs. I'm actually interviewing Ted Fleming, the founder of Partake, tomorrow on the podcast. Ooh. And he's got a really great line of non-alcoholic beers that are down to like 25, 30 carbs. So yeah, you want to jump into it and tell us a little bit about why you decided to launch that venture, and would love to get the update on it.
Yeah, I think in short explanation is I'm a celiac. And so I was a home brewer. I was brewing at home when I found out I had celiac disease, immediately took beer off the menu for me.
Wow.
And so I, you know, that sort of launched me on this. How do I figure this out? How do I find a good product? And over the years, that what got me started in the category. And it's just something that I still, even through my own efforts, haven't been able to completely lock down. And so, you know, we've gone through lots of fits and starts. And unfortunately, the last one was disrupted by COVID. And it was our last big effort to try to bring a product to market again in the United States. And we just couldn't survive the pandemic. So since then, I've been trying to figure it out. How do I do this? How do I make it work again? Found a new partner, someone I used to work with, actually, who already has an operating brewery. He's interested in a gluten-free product for his brewery. And so that gives me the opportunity to do it again. So we're going to bring a gluten-free product to market. Yeah.
So how have the options been so far? Like, have you guys gotten to sample like stuff that you've been able to taste? Like, what's the user experience like?
Yeah, for the most part, if it's a gluten-free beer, I stop short of saying it's not very good. What it's not is what you think of as beer if you're a regular beer drinker. So, I mean, there's actually quite a few brewers out there that make really good products with sorghum, with rice, with millet, with buckwheat. And they're very interesting, but it's not quite the same flavor profile that beer drinkers are used to. So it's different. And in my case, of course, I was drinking beer as an adult when I found out I couldn't have it anymore. So I find those to be poor substitutes. But the process that we've developed is the way I would tell people, it's kind of like decaffeinating coffee. We go in and we grab that one offensive protein that has nothing to do with flavor or color or foam. And we take it out, and the beer is effectively the same as any other beer you would think to drink, except now it's safe for people like me. So it's, if you're a celiac like me, it's life-changing. If you just ever wanted a beer, this is going to be a beer that actually tastes the way you remember, only it doesn't offend our system.
I love it, man. That's awesome. Yeah. My niece is celiac. So we spend a lot of time with my brother-in-law searching out restaurants that are completely gluten-free. And, you know, it's a great experience. You know, I probably have a sensitivity. I just am not willing to get tested and like actually give it up yet. But
sure.
You know, 42, and so far it hasn't, you know, completely ruined things for me. But I'm interested. How do you, as a specialty brewer, how do you plan on attacking the kind of the tier three system that the alcohol industry is regulated under, where you need to have distributors and like how do you go direct to consumer? Are you guys going to start with like trying to roll it out regionally? Are you going to use like a Vino shipper or something so you guys can ship online? Like what's the go-to-market strategy?
Yeah, the first thinking is, of course, we're going to self-distribute because the brewery here locally already has a footprint. It's actually growing. And so there's some advantages to self-distributing because, of course, the margin is better for the brewer. You keep a larger share of it, but it adds the complexity of the trucking and, of course, all the direct retailer relationships. But that's the best way to get started for a smaller brewery because you control more of the value chain. You control the experience. And if you're a celiac and you're going to make a celiac beer or a gluten-free beer, that value chain is actually really important because, for example, we can't keg a beer and take it to a regular bar unless we really trust that bar to take care of their lines so that the patrons like me don't unintentionally get cross-contaminated. So we're going to start with full control, self-distribution, and then we're toying with a strategy that would let us take it outside of our own region. But that's sort of long-term. Right now, we're going to start in our backyard. We're going to prove the model out, prove it to the consumers that care. Then we will expand.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. You know, I've worked with wine clients in the past and, you know, it's kind of like the Facebook. You guys are kind of forced to because of the tier three system, but
yes.
I think it's best to attack an alcohol brand or a spirits brand or a beer brand. Start local, you know, figure out, you know, I talked to a wine company recently. If they get 140 accounts, they're a profitable business and on their way to being evaluated for $10 million. So, you know, you find a few regional franchises that have a few doors and, you know, you can kind of tie in and it seems like, sure, there's no shortage of opportunities there in Texas to start local.
It's true. And I just actually think local's better. I mean, we've seen in the beer industry, for example, there's been a rise of some craft breweries who were acquired for major dollars and then went national. And it's been a struggle for most of those brands. I actually like the idea of beer being local. And so if we can start there, not only is that probably strategically smart, but I just think it's better. I think people like a local brewer. And so we want to be able to be that.
Yeah, no, I love that idea. Well, cool. Hey, I want to hop into your experience as a fractional at Chief Outsiders. So first of all, what made you decide to go fractional? It is a trend right now. It's kind of hot with especially, you know, the industry saying the death of the full-time CMO is upon us. But I mean, from all the Chief Outsiders that I've spoken to, they love it. They're having the best years of their career, the best years of their life. They love the idea of working on multiple pieces of business and getting to flex their brain in different ways. They love the partnership effect that it comes from having a network of fractionals like Chief Outsiders. So tell me a little bit about why you decided to go fractional and what do you love about fractional marketing roles?
I mean, you've nailed it. It's the different clients with the different challenges. It's very, you know, intellectually stimulating. It's also just fun. You know, the clients that come to us, they're looking for growth and they're ready to really look to someone to help them do that. And so by the time we get engaged, they're really interested in our experience, interested in the suggestions that we can make, because it's a material difference for them, which is different than being, in many cases, the corporate CMO. A lot of times what happens is you move up that food chain, if you will, and you go through your career, you reach a point where the majority of your work is really political, or at least it's all human management, right? And I'm not saying that's not a good experience, because it is, but you get separated from getting your hands on the work that really you can see an immediate impact and see the growth impact that business and the people that run it. And that's really rewarding. You know, if you're in a position actually to make an impact that you can see pretty quickly, and then see that what that does to the people involved in that business, it's just really fun. So you get your hands on the work, it's a little less political, and it's a little more tangible. And of course, it's different. So I've had lots of different clients now in lots of different industries, and it's the variety of that is just really exciting.
Yeah, I love that. I work for Howard Bragman right out of college, who was the founder of the PR firm Bragman Nyman Caffarelli. And he actually sold BNC to Interpublic specifically for the thing that you mentioned, which is that he wasn't doing PR anymore. He was managing the HR, you know, department and figuring out what tax system to use. And, you know, yes, there was a lot of high level strategy and leadership going into being the CEO of a large PR firm, but he sure as heck wasn't doing a lot of PR work anymore.
Right.
So I imagine for guys like you who've got this wealth of experience, you know, it's probably fun to kind of roll up your sleeves and get back into the nitty gritty, so to speak.
It's definitely fun. And, you know, the other thing is it's just enjoyable to be in such an active role. You do get separated from the business. And so it's really fun to sort of get in there and actually build these things. A lot of times too, you know, you're a CMO, you've risen to a company that's fairly mature if they have a CMO that's full time. And in those mature companies, you might not always be building and growing at the rate that you are maybe when you're a younger person in your career. In this role, everybody that comes to us is looking to accelerate growth. And I have found through my career that that's the job I gravitate towards. It's the thing that's broken, the thing that's stuck, or the thing that really is looking for hyper growth. Those are the things I've always sort of found myself in charge of. This role fractionally puts me into that every single day. So I really get to work on growth, acceleration, and I just think that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And I imagine, you know, a lot of the fractionals that I've spoken to, whether they're part of chief outsiders or independent fractionals, they tend to have a vertical that is maybe an inch wide and a mile deep, which I think is good, you know, to have category experience. So, you know, I've interviewed one chief outsider that, you know, was the CMO of only small to medium sized restaurant QSR brands. And I've interviewed one that has like a really deep B2B portfolio. I think you're the first one that I've come across, as I alluded to at the beginning of the conversation, that has B2C experience, nonprofit experience, and B2B experience. So do you kind of look for projects across the spectrum, or is there a sweet spot for the types of things that you want to get involved with, or how do you decide which projects to take on?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the answer is that I look for anything that's interesting where I feel like I can actually make a difference. I do see some things come across my desk where while I'm certain, and I'm sure my colleagues do as well, that we could do that job, I know the strength of our group and there's someone in our group that's better for that client. And so I would prefer that client get that person that's best suited to their challenge. So there are things I turn down, but I'm definitely, it's driven by what I find interesting. I do tend to look for things where I have some immediate background because I think that experience is immediately applicable to that client. So like you said, there may be B2C in a beverage space, or there might be B2B in a technology space where I have an awful lot of experience where it's obvious that I'd like to throw my hat in the ring for those things, right? But largely, I'm looking at what I find interesting. I suppose I tend to gravitate towards anything in a technology space just because that's the bulk of my experience. But it's been technology B2B and technology B2C. So I don't limit myself that way. But if it's technology, I do tend to get a little more interested.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I couldn't help but notice when I was doing the research on you this morning that we are both fellow Sigma Chi brothers, which is something that has come up at least one time on the podcast before. I had the pleasure of interviewing Keith Kroc, who was the grand president of Sigma Chi at one time, grand consul.
Yep.
Also the founder of Ariba, which sold to SAP for, I think, $4 billion.
Good for him.
Launched DocuSign, chairman of Angie's List. And not only that, but he's been, you know, in major roles in our fraternity and has really given back a ton. I can, you know, say that Sigma Chi is probably one of the formative things in my background that led me to the career that I've been able to have, whether it's from lessons that I learned through running a small business in college, essentially by running the fraternity, whether it was seeing the power of the alumni network when I got out and got involved in alumni chapter life and giving back at the national level, to just Sigma Chi's that I've networked that were willing to like give me a leg up or become a client, stuff like that.
Sure.
I was wondering if you had any similar stories, you know, from your, you know, you were a chapter president, I think I read somewhere. I was never front table, but, you know, I did a lot of things, but would just be curious if you have any interesting Sigma Chi stories to share along your career trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for me, it was a hugely formative experience. I suppose, like many people, I went to college. I wasn't exactly sure what I was getting into. I wasn't one of these kids that came out and knew the whole time I was going to be a CMO, and that's what I was aiming at. So, you know, Sigma Chi provided me a lot of structure. You know, I think a lot of people think of the fraternity, you know, there are stereotypes, some of them are negative, but one of the really big positive ones that I don't think it talked about enough is the leadership training that a fraternity can offer you. So I came in, I ultimately became consul, and the process of not only the organization representing your fraternity on campus, as well as really leading a group of young men to achieve things that are in the fraternity's aims, what a great training ground. I can tell you, I worked into my career and levered the experience of understanding the organizational principles, understanding how to influence people, and how, in fact, to be a part of that process with them, as opposed to maybe thinking of it from a top-down perspective. So a lot of the management things that I brought to start my career came from Sigma Chi. It's really fascinating for me right now, because my son is a Sigma Chi at the University of Alabama, and he's just become a chair. Yeah. And first of all, as a dad, it's one of the coolest things ever. It's something I always hoped for. And I'm lucky because he found the right fraternity for him, which luckily was our fraternity. And now he's taking leadership roles. And what's fascinating is he's calling me and he's saying, you know, gee, dad, this is actually quite hard. Or gee, dad, what a great experience I just had. I had to do all of this work, but then it worked. Right. And this came to fruition and I got to see how that works. And so I'm seeing from a different chair the impact of that leadership training ground that the fraternity is on my own son. And I'm really grateful that he's there.
Yeah, that's really cool. You know, I had girls. I had my girls are 8 and 10 year old, and we weren't planning to have any more kids. And we had a surprise last year, and he was a boy. I'd kind of written it off and was like, at least I got to initiate my brother, because my brother was a SIG at Washington State, and that was a pretty cool experience to like fly up and go to his initiation and stuff like that. But, you know, I think as dads, we always have that legacy. So I'm looking forward to having that same experience someday, hopefully. But yeah, just going back to, you know, some of the things that you talked about. I mean, you know, for me, I went to film school, so I basically watched movies from my college career. And it was not very hard, but it did kind of get me into the marketing and the entertainment world, which I'm very grateful for. But yeah, I mean, as far as like leadership and like running a small business, it was definitely my undergraduate experience at the fraternity house that really set me up for just starting to understand like some of the principles. Like the main one for me was around, so when I came in, they gave me alumni chairman. And prior to me coming on board for alumni chairman, our version of alumni weekend was basically buy a keg, put it in the backyard, and if people show up, they show up. It was like literally like no effort. And, you know, the alumni kind of knew we were just a bunch of, you know, knuckleheads, and they put up with it, but we just didn't do much. But when I took over, I basically had 3 business cards in my room. And, you know, it was kind of the typical thing, right, where like alumni would show up at 2 o'clock in the morning because there was a wedding in Santa Barbara and they got to hair up their butt to like go out to IV and like kick down the doors and say hi to guys. But whatever, like I had 3 business cards. That's the only alumni that I knew. I inherited no database, nothing. And I emailed those 3 guys and I said, hey, guys, I want to start by just like getting in touch with everybody. So can you guys give me the email addresses of all your friends? And then they did. And then I did the same thing. Wow. And by the time I left, we were back in active communication with 600 of our 1200 living alumni. And then just weird stuff started happening. Like, you know, guys would drop off pool tables and, you know, guys would send us checks out of nowhere for no reason. And it was like, okay, wow, there's something to this idea of just like, if you build it, they will come, so to speak.
Sure.
And by the time I left, I nominated our very first 2 significant SIGs, Eric Fenoy, who is a Olympic gold medalist for beach volleyball, Brett White, who is the CEO of CB Richard Ellis, and Brad Dewey, who was the president of Napster back when Napster was a thing. And it was pretty cool. And then we also had our 40th reunion while I was still an undergraduate, and we got to get all of our founders back in a room together before some of them passed away.
Wow. Shortly after that. So, that's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's cool.
I have found that even now, so I stay involved. I'm the part of the Dallas Alumni Club here, even though I'm sort of between Dallas and Fort Worth. And a guy named Ron Hunt runs the Dallas group, and I think it's regarded as one of the better alumni groups. And I've been impressed. He pulls in all kinds of people. I call guys that are in the fraternity. We're going to play in the golf tournament, by the way. I don't know if you remember L. Wayne Tucker, who was Grand Consul a few years back. So he was local. He was from here in North Texas. And so we're starting a golf tournament in his honor. And the first one, I think it's May 18th. So any SIGs that are out there in the area, May 18th is going to be the first one. And so I stay involved, and I found the network to be fantastic.
Yeah, that's amazing. And are you the guys that do the wild game dinner where you guys shoot all the animals?
No, I think it's Houston that does it. They just had it, and a bunch of guys from here went down. Yeah.
Yeah, I hear that's an experience. I feel like I need to go someday.
The photos look great. So
that's awesome, man. Well, cool. Well, I wanted to pivot to another thing that I read in your bio. So I read that you are an avid tennis player in addition to practicing martial arts. I'm a big believer that exercise is not only important for the body and your long-term health, but for me, I use it as like a way to stack my day and to get energy, but I also use it for my creative process. So just curious, how do you use exercise to stack your day? But then also, how does that feed into your creative process as a creative executive?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for me, it keeps my head clear. Long time ago, I was living in New York around the time of September 11th, and there was obviously a lot of stress in that period, right? Yeah. And I'd have always been pretty active anyway, because I just like to be active. But it came to relief for me during that period because I started marathon training at the time. And so there was job stress, there was country stress, there was every stress you can imagine living there at that time. And I found very tangibly that it kept me even keel. It let me manage a lot of that stress. And so what I saw as something I did because I just enjoyed it quickly became something that I realized was a tool for managing stress, maintaining creativity, and just mental health broadly. So ever since then, and maybe I'm one of those people that as they got older, that was a reason I didn't drop off. I don't know. I'd like to think I was always a guy that was going to keep exercising, but who knows? The statistics are probably against me. Maybe that contributed. But it keeps me mentally well. It keeps me obviously healthy broadly. And I just enjoy those activities. So I played tennis my whole life. I love the game. It's very challenging. It's individual. It's kind of you on an island unless you're playing doubles. But it's, you know, very, very athletic in just about every way. And it's very aerobic as well. And there's power and there's speed and there's all those things. So I've just always loved the game. And so I've stayed playing that. And I got into martial arts, I suppose, in college. And then I had a long layoff period. And I kind of got bored with the workout I was doing and went looking for a heavy bag to hit. Found my way in a gym. And 5 years later, you know, I'm a purple belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And I and I really, really like it because it scares the hell out of me. It's unlike anything else I've ever done. It's extremely humbling, but at the same time, it generates a lot of sort of calm self-confidence too. I mean, there's something about putting a lot of life stress into relief versus, you know, a 300-pound guy trying to choke you. So
yeah,
kind of evens that out a little bit.
Yeah, I love it. No, that's awesome because I didn't know that you were going to speak to jiu-jitsu specifically, but I'm also a blue belt in jiu-jitsu.
Hey, all right, that's mine right back there, sitting on the
mat. Oh, let's go. Yeah, nice. mine is, mine's in the office somewhere. I've been thinking of cutting it off at the stripes and like putting in some kind of a mount or something like that. But so I've been on and off with jiu-jitsu basically since high school. I'm sad that I didn't stick with it and like, I would have been a black belt by now for sure, or at least, you know. But I kind of got back into it after starting to listen to Jocko Willink's podcast.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, just like the amount of application, you know, of jiu-jitsu to life skills. You know, I'm a surfer, so there's a lot of surfers who are cross training jiu-jitsu right now because being choked out is very similar to being held under a wave. So, you know, to have that. Yeah. So just to have that like responsiveness of being able to like not freak out, not panic, you know, let the wave have its way with you. And then once it's done, then swim to the top versus trying to fight your way to the top. When it's big and hairy, you know, like on a regular day, you don't have to worry about that stuff. But I find a lot of application and, you know, I've been really blessed to like meet really cool people through jiu-jitsu. Like, speaking of Jocko, like a guy named Chris King, who actually worked for me, was one of my sales reps, now runs marketing for Origin up in Maine.
Oh, wow.
And, and another guy that I roll with here in San Diego, his name is Jonathan. He either is or at least has been their e-commerce guy. So, you know, I found it really a great place to meet people as well. Like, you know, like-minded guys that are out there, you know, swapping spit and whatnot is a great place to like meet, you know, people who are, you know, if you're into jiu-jitsu, like it's kind of like CrossFit or being a vegan, right? Like everybody likes to talk about it.
It is. I suppose it feels a little cultish that way, but I totally agree with what you said about remaining calm. I mean, I have a little bit of claustrophobia. And man, I had to get over that fast. I mean, real fast. And it does teach you that even though you're feeling extremely uncomfortable, you can actually handle it. It's actually a little surprising what you can handle once you start doing it. And you get used to being uncomfortable. And I think, like you said, used to staying calm and using your head when you're uncomfortable, it does train you on that. And so I've found that to be hugely beneficial. And by the way, I'm jealous about San Diego. I lived there for 5 years in Encinitas, and it's my place. So
yeah, it sounds like you've lived in a lot of really cool places. I mean, I'm in Carlsbad, so I'm basically North Encinitas. But New York is beautiful. I've never got the opportunity to live there, but I love to visit.
Yeah, I've been blessed. I mean, they've all been good. People will ask me, where was your favorite place? And I'd say, well, you know, I was in these great places at really different life stages. And so they've all been great. I mean, we were in Chicago, we were in New York, we were in San Diego. We've lived in Dallas several times. I worked out of London for a year. I worked out of Latin America for a year. I used to travel to Finland regularly. And so these, you know, they've all been great places for that time in my life.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Well, I sadly have been Southern California bound, but I've traveled extensively, and mainly is because my wife is, you know, fifth generation San Diego, and it's hard to take a San Diego native out of San Diego once you get her back.
Well, I don't think you should hang your head. It does not suck. It's a great place.
No, it's awesome. But, you know, the travel allows me to experience, you know, the richness of like other places and even other countries and stuff like that. So
sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'd like to pivot the conversation to focus a little bit on my area of the marketing channel. So we focus on the influencer marketing segment. I'm sure you've had experience with influencers across all three of the sections that you've worked in, whether it was philanthropy or direct consumer branding or B2B. But we as an agency are focused on the emergence of the B2B influencers, specifically on LinkedIn as a platform. So we believe that this is the year that LinkedIn officially becomes a creator-centric platform. You're seeing signs that they are rolling out things like thought leader ads, where you can boost a post from somebody outside of your organization as an ad, not just promote assets from your own media channel on LinkedIn, but also just the idea that there are all these folks, experts, solopreneurs, freelancers, et cetera, building followings on LinkedIn around specific niches, around different types of expertise in the B2B world. So as somebody who has some pretty deep experience in B2B, what are your thoughts on LinkedIn becoming a social media platform, an influencer marketing platform? And do you have any experience leveraging it in that way?
Yeah, a little. I think what I'm really interested in is I'm glad LinkedIn exists as a way for business people to connect. Mm-hmm. I find there's a huge difference between LinkedIn and say Facebook or Instagram or any number of other platforms. They're all different in sort of what their strengths are. And so I always am happy that LinkedIn exists so that you've got that business community and they have a place to gather. in terms of influencers, I think it's great because I serve a lot of clients in different industries, right? And like we talked about, sometimes B2B, sometimes B2C. But a lot of these industries are not as visible as, say, consumer packaged goods. I mean, there's a lot of people paying attention to what Coke and Pepsi do, but maybe they're not paying as much attention to a wholesaler that's in a B2B space. But you can get influencers in that space that can aggregate thought leadership in a way there that's very genuine and is underserved. So that's what I think is really fascinating about that, is you can get through influencers of maybe the really visible nature, some exposure for your brand or for your company, but you can actually get that in so many other ways that as media and the landscape sort of for trades, for example, has changed, this opens up a brand new way to reach audiences in a really, really relevant way. So I'll tell you candidly, I haven't figured out exactly how to use it yet for all of those spaces, but I'm encouraged that it's going on. So I think it's going to open up new vehicles.
Yeah, no, that's exciting. Yeah, no, I think what's fun for me is just doing the audits for customers to find out if there are influencers talking about their brands or talking about their category. And obviously in B2B, you know, you can get so niche. Like for instance, today I talked to a gal who runs B2B for a SaaS company that focuses on end of month reconciliation. So you could figure who would be influential to that group of people? And, you know, it's CFOs, it's accounting folks. So whether there are quote unquote influencers talking about accounting, maybe, maybe not, but there are definitely freelancers out there that have built a lot of credibility and audiences around that topic. And there are even professionals that might be inside of those target accounts that have built credibility and authority around those topics that can be leveraged. So another one that I thought was really interesting was a SaaS company that's going after strategic planning professionals. Mm-hmm. And we found some really influential people around something that we thought was going to be maybe a little bit too specific. There was still some folks that had audience around that. So yeah, it's early days, but I think you're going to see a lot more of this in the coming months and weeks. So we're pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, I really see that as making a lot of sense. I mean, because I have, again, clients in some very tight niches like you're talking about, and this gives you a campfire for those people to gather. You know, one of the things that Chief Outsiders does that I think is one of our greatest aspects is the group of CMOs and now CSOs is really good about sharing their expertise. And so we do something called peer review for our clients where you reach a point with your client where either you're stuck or you just want feedback. I can gather 20, 30 of my colleagues from various industries and expertise, bounce an issue off of them and get feedback. LinkedIn's good for that for guys like us, right? Our guys and ladies and men both, really who are trying to find colleagues over a particular topic. But the challenge that you find with that is, if I called you, you're busy, you have a full-time job. Maybe you're really into beer and so am I, but I've got to ask you to put that down to talk to me about beer, even if you're passionate about it, right? Well, Chief Outsiders peer reviews, I don't have to have that problem. They're already willing to help. Influencers on a given topic, again, and people that follow them and opt in, they're already willing to help. They're already willing to converse over that, right? Whereas it's either a part of their day job or they're so passionate about it that you can get dialogue going over something that might seem otherwise too small, or maybe it's a nuisance for your close friends. So, you know, you talk about those influencers starting to gather people together. I think that's actually really, really valuable, particularly in those niche areas where, you know, it wouldn't otherwise come together.
Yeah, I love that. And what a cool opportunity, that peer review process. I mean, if you think about it, where else in the world can you get a focus group of 20 to 30 CMOs to give you feedback on a particular marketing challenge that you're facing? Like, you can do that through your friends, but to have a network like that, that's pretty powerful.
Right. And my friends, if any of them see this, they're lovely. They're willing to help me, but they have jobs and they have other things. And, you know, the group of Chief Outsiders is really dedicated to helping you. And I've done it for my clients. They've all loved it. Because like you said, they get 20, 30 different points of view that maybe it's something I didn't think of. I mean, I've been a CMO for a while, but it doesn't mean I'm perfect. And you get the strength of this whole group. So it's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is powerful about that is you're not only getting the strength of the network, but the strength of a bunch of CMOs that have different expertise and different skills, different verticals. Yes. Like a lot of times, like my best ideas come from other verticals sometimes. Like what's beauty doing that could be relevant to automotive, or what's gaming doing that could be relevant to travel? You know, sometimes getting out of your, you know, your bubble of your category can be sometimes the key to breaking through with that insight.
Right. Exactly. And I don't mean to carry on about the point, but it's just been hugely impactful for my clients. And I found it useful too, because sometimes I've gone to the group because I got stuck on something. Right. And that conversation not only got me unstuck, but brought me fresh ideas.
That's cool, man. All right, buddy. Well, hey, we're getting to the final stretch here. So what are you most excited about, say, for the next 6 months to a year in your role as a chief outsider?
Yeah, I'm transitioning a little bit. So I've benefited from the Chief Outsider's sort of branding and marketing. And all of my clients to date have come from the organization sourcing them. And so now I've kind of got a new goal where I want to actually build my own pipeline, source my own customers. And even though I've been a marketer for a long time, I've never marketed me. It's a little strange, to be honest. It's just not something I'm necessarily used to. So I am relying on my colleagues, but that's one of the big things I'm looking forward to for this year, is learning how to attract clients and sort of source them myself and bring them into the organization that way. So that's going to be fun. And that's just on top of the general work itself. I mean, it's just fun to deal with different people in different industries with different challenges, you know, be in a position to help them and see them grow. It's just fun. So that's going to be great to continue that, but it'll be great to maybe even do that sourcing them myself for a change.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I love that vulnerability because I think most of us as marketers, we're guilty of doing really great work for our clients, but a lot of times we don't drink our own Kool-Aid and we don't either market ourselves or market our agencies well. Yeah, same. I mean, for me, the other, there were two blessings of COVID. Well, I would say maybe even more than that, but the one that I'll focus on is, you know, prior to COVID, I used to travel 50% of the time, and I had about $500,000 budget that I would use to either go to conferences, do lunch and learns, you know, all of the kind of the whining and dining of being a revenue guy in the marketing world. And that all came screaming to a halt in COVID, obviously. And we all had to basically learn in real time, how do we become pull marketers versus push sales guys? Sure. And we had to like drink our own Kool-Aid. So we launched a newsletter strategy, a blog strategy. We bought media as an agency. We did influencer marketing as an agency for the first time. We launched this podcast. We launched a podcast for my CEO. So yeah, you know, I think there are a lot of really good ways to do it. You know, having this conversation with you today, I know that you've got the chops and the insights that an audience would find valuable. So I think it's just about, you know, creating that schedule of getting the reps in and doing the things that you know you need to do to put yourself out there. I think you're going to do great at it as long as you just come up with that roadmap of, you know, here are the next indicated steps that I got to do every single day to get my message out in the market as an individual versus doing it for your clients.
Yeah, well, you nailed it. That's what I'm going to try to do. I'm already working on my calendar, trying to set time aside and be diligent about it. It takes some discipline, and I'm just not used to that for me. So, but that's exactly what I hope to do.
I love it. Well, awesome, man. Well, hey, great interview. Anything else you want to plug while I've got you?
I would just plug, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I think more people should do it. Get out of your comfort zone, right? Try it. It's not as scary as you think it is. And I actually think it's really good for you.
Yeah, I agree. And then the last thing I'll say on Jiu-Jitsu is it's not a bunch of tough guys, you know, looking to, you know, figure out how to kill people on the street. Honestly, I've become less aggressive. I was never a fighter. I've never gotten fist fights and stuff like that, even in college or high school. But what it does do is, like, you know, when I get into those interesting situations where I have an awareness, you know, out in the world that I might not be safe, for just a moment, you know, I feel like I can, you know, handle myself if I had to. Like, I was in the Dominican Republic recently, basically living like essentially a citizen, you know, going around to places that locals go to, not where tourists go, because I was doing a trip that was kind of recon for the cigar industry. And, you know, not that I would ever need to, or, you know, if I had to, at least I know that I can, you know, potentially, hopefully get myself out of a sticky situation. Yeah. Just gives you that base level of confidence, you know?
Yeah, and it, like you said, it keeps you calm, keeps your head clear. And I think you make better decisions that way.
Yeah, no, I love it. All right, everybody. Well, hey, if you enjoyed this episode, no matter where you are, wherever you're listening or watching, go ahead and give us a follow or a subscribe. And if you decide to review the episode, that's how we find a larger audience more naturally. And most importantly, if you enjoyed the conversation that I had with Jason today, don't forget to share it with a colleague that you think might get some value from it. And if you're a Sigma Chi, you know, just go ahead and share it with your whole pledge class, you know, because we would appreciate it. The Brotherhood would appreciate it. So anyways, thanks so much, Jason. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Dylan. I appreciate you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers.